This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Greetings, putrid pain slaves, and welcome to another infernal episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com. .death.
We are in the throes of October, and I'm so fucking excited because obviously...
we're going to do something no one else is doing.
Get ready for this podcast listening universe. Get ready to have your minds blown. We, all through the month of October, are going to talk about... horror movies.
Holy shit.
I know, right?
Wow.
We have such sights.
What
to
a
show
twist.
You. Such sights you will get on every other podcast for the next 30 days. And that's fine because no one is going to slap the special sauce on it the way that we will. And I can promise you that legally, they can't. They are under strict FDA regulations that we are not. Who are we? We're Junk Food Cinema, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I'm Brian. He's Cargill. Angels to some, devils to others. Basically, just Junk Food Cinema in a nutshell. I think it depends on how much affinity you have for John Cryer. I think is whether we're an angel or a demon to you. How much affinity you have for Battle Truck. That is really the deciding factor. Cargill has a book that's out right now because he writes the things that people can buy. So you go buy Sea of Rust. You do it. You do it now. You open that puzzle box and you let those words into your eye holes. Feel free to jump in anytime.
I know you normally you throw it out to me and you're like, "What you up to, Cargill? How you doing?" And I'd be like, "Well, I'm sucking down a mule." But instead, you're
and he's
just
not speaking
like,
figuratively, folks.
Yeah, no, I'm having a Kentucky mule and it's
Kentucky
delicious.
Kentucky mule. Now, what is a Kentucky mule other than a very expensive sex position?
It's a ginger beer with bourbon and lime juice.
I love it. I love it.
It is a tasty beverage for a nice, sweltering, hot October night here in Texas.
We don't have fall in Texas. We just have late summer, 2 weeks of winter, and then back to summer.
Yeah, well, no, we do have a spring. I mean, we have a nice spring that eases in. But...
oh, you mean the monsoon season?
Yeah. But aside from that, so we are in sweltering hot-tober.
Yeah.
And we're watching horror movies this month, but we're actually using it as an excuse to kind of round up a bunch of the stuff we've been wanting to talk about for a while.
Yes.
That it was like, hey, you know, we can do it as a horror month for October and give people some interesting things to watch.
Yes, so if you're on Twitter following Junk Food Cinema, which you should be, hashtag Schlocktober2, because we did this once before, and you can consider this the sequel, which is fitting, because what we're talking about today isn't just one classic horror film. It is a classic horror film and one of its many sequels in a double-wide episode of Junk Food Cinema.
We're talking about Hellraisers, plural.
I have seen the future of horror. His name is Clive Barker. Hellraiser. Beyond any terror you have imagined. A nightmare.
No.
Unlike anything you have witnessed. Is born. Because within these walls, the unholy is unleashed. Hellraiser, a film by Clive Barker.
We'll tear your soul apart.
And we're talking about this for a reason, actually. Like, this is a conversation we've been having for a few months. There were a number of you who said, you're doing Summer of 87 and you haven't talked about Hellraiser. And Brian was very much like, hey, Cargill, why don't you want to talk about Hellraiser? And it's because I have a love-hate relationship with Hellraiser.
Oh, I do too. And it was funny to find that we were on common ground there because I remember seeing this for the first time as I sort of rounded the bases on the final quote-unquote classics of horror and the ones that filling in the gaps. And I remember watching this the first time and thinking, that's it's not my cup of tea. It really doesn't work for me. And so when people were asking us why we weren't covering Hellraiser for Summer of 87, it was entirely because we just didn't get to it. I mean, we really didn't start having the conversation about whether or not to cover Hellraiser for Summer of 87 until we got to the very end of the series.
I was being very passive-aggressive about that. I'll admit that. I was very much like skipping over it in the, oh, hey, look, yeah, this movie. And okay, we'll cover that. Not realizing I keep deliberately skipping over Hellraiser. Because what we ended up talking about was, if I were to talk about Hellraiser, I wanted to talk about it in a double episode in which we would talk about Hellraiser and Hellraiser 2 together. Because I love, unrepentantly, Hellraiser 2.
And I think I know why, and I'm going to speak to that later.
We'll get into a lot of this. This is going to be an in-depth episode on this. But I love, love, love Hellraiser 2, and I accept Hellraiser for two reasons. One, because it is half of a brilliant film. There is a lot of genius stuff in Hellraiser, but it is also almost just kind of like a prequel to Hellraiser 2, as if Hellraiser 2 in my head is the Hellraiser movie, and then Hellraiser's the movie that fills in all the blanks that you're trying to understand that isn't completely wrapped up in all the flashbacks in Hellraiser 2. Mm-hmm. It's a movie I revisit once every decade or so.
Sure.
Whereas I'll watch Hellraiser 2 a couple of times in a decade. This is the second time I've watched Hellraiser 2 in a year. It was up late one night and it was on Shudder, and Jess had already passed out on my chest and I wanted to watch another movie, and I'm like, fuck it, Hellraiser 2 time. So when you were like, hey, let's do this, I'm like, well, I don't need to rewatch Hellraiser 2, but after watching Hellraiser, I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm watching Hellraiser 2 right now.
Absolutely. And I had actually never seen Hellraiser 2. So when you proposed idea of covering Hellraiser and Hellraiser 2 together, I was intrigued because Hellraiser is sort of the one horror franchise that I have been hesitant to dip my toes into because of how little I cared for the first one. To me, the concept of going further, committing further to something that you didn't like initially is bonkers. So I never bothered with the sequels.
Which I only think 2 and Scott Derrickson's Inferno are the only ones of note, the only ones really worth watching. 3 is just a terrible movie. 4 is a movie that the original script was a really bold, interesting idea, but got the budget cut and became a mangled mess as a result.
Mangled mess, by the way, a great alternate title for the first Hellraiser.
That is also true. And then of the direct-to-video versions, I only think that Scott's is the only worthy one. And I'm not alone in that. So I don't feel like I'm just fluffing my writing partner. I feel honestly that, you know, anybody that has watched the Hellraisers, most of them say the people that dislike Scott's only dislike it because he did something wildly different, which is what a lot of people really admire about it. Because it's like there's not a lot of things to do with Hellraiser once you get past Hellraiser 2. But let's get deep into it. Let's start with Hellraiser.
We have such sights to show you.
Let's start with Hellraiser, indeed. So this is a story all about how these people's lives got flipped, turned upside down, because they flipped and turned upside down a puzzle box, and shit goes bad. Whenever you have an object, and there's like an ominous warning, an ominous like benefit that it
what
gives you.
What is your pleasure,
yeah,
sir?
Don't fight. Why? Why in Satan's red hell would you ever think it's a good idea to open that box?
Well, in this particular case, this is one of the things that really works in this film. The thing is that Frank, as he's presented, is a guy who cannot be sated. He cannot have his desires sated. He's done everything. As we start going through his pictures in the box, we get a very subtle look, a very quick look at just all the wild variation in his sex life, and he cannot find satisfaction, so much to the point that when he shows up to his brother's wedding, he's got to try to bang the fucking bride to just see if that will get him off.
Yeah.
And so he's gotten to the point where even that fucking his brother's wife isn't doing it for him in terms of kink. And he hears the story about the ultimate pleasure and the ultimate merging of pleasure and pain, and that there is a doorway to this place that is unlike anything you've ever experienced. And that's the only thing left for him to fuck with. And I find that element and that portion of Frank a truly inspired piece of writing.
You want to go where everyone enjoys your pain. And that's, he walks into the cheers of hell and he meets lovable Norm, in this case, Pinhead, which is something I really want to talk about before we even go any further. When you think of Hellraiser, if you are a casual horror film viewer, when you think of Hellraiser, you immediately think of Pinhead. You immediately think of the character played by Doug Bradley. And the thing about Pinhead in the first Hellraiser is he's kind of a co-star in his own movie. He's not quite as much as Jason Voorhees in the first Friday the 13th, but he's on the fucking sidelines. Like, this movie, and what works the most for me about this movie, is the story of a reincarnated sex fiend slash adulterer slash general bad guy who's, you know, illicit affair with the matriarch of this family leads to a real fucked up relationship where she is basically luring men to be murdered by him so that he can absorb their energy and be brought back from a hell dimension. Like, I can see that short story in the first two acts of this movie. Like, as it's being played out, I'm like, oh, I can see the borders of the short story and how well that would work as a short story. And for me, where it goes wrong is when you start seeing more and more of the Cenobites, because that's when you get into this realm of the film that is very goopy, it's very icky, I think the word that kept coming to my mind was primordial, because there's literally a scene where Frank emerges from soup, and it's like basically...
Well, this is, keep in mind that this movie is existing in the pinnacle, you know, just at peak splatterpunk. Like, this is what's going on in movies. Like, as we've talked about so far with the Friday the 13th and the Nightmare on Elm Street, they were just getting gorier and gorier, and it was all about effects. And, you know, Fangoria was selling this idea. Like, this was...
Oh, this feels like Fangoria the movie. Like, yes. When you hear the word Fangoria, this is the first movie I think of.
Yeah, and so it is very much... And this is part of what I love about this movie. Half of what is brilliant about this movie is contained in the technical elements of the other people brought in to make this movie. I love the physical effects in this movie. I love the creature design in the movie. And... Oh my God, oh my God, do I love the score by Christopher Young, who I was so lucky to work with on Sinister. And the reason I was so excited to work with him on Sinister was because part of what works about the two Hellraiser movies is his score. Mm-hmm. Like, that score is just so iconic when you hear it. It's just so great. And it makes the movie feel so much bigger budget than it is, because that's Chris's gift. And so when I was like, holy fuck, the guy who did Hellraiser and Hellraiser 2 is scoring my fucking horror movie, I'm losing my fucking mind right now, because this score is that fucking good. But that's where I think that and a few of the ideas that Clive Barker is offering is where the brilliance ends. Like, it's all contained in that. But going back to what you're talking about, this movie is soupy as fuck. Like, there is blood everywhere. There's a point where after Frank gets torn to pieces, that for no apparent reason, Pinhead just collects all the pieces of his face and puts it together on the ground just because it's a fucked up thing to do.
Can I say that I feel like that might be how Jeff Dunham makes his puppets? I feel like he rips people apart.
Well, and then, he clearly got his career from a deal with Satan.
I mean, obviously, yes.
I mean, who honestly gets a real career with racist puppets?
The most, like, racist puppets
ever. Like, how does that happen? Clearly, the devil is involved.
I agreed.
No, don't do that.
But the thing about the gore in this movie, yes, there's a lot of the effects that I do appreciate. I appreciate the technical expertise that was required here. What I don't appreciate are the literal scenes of spinning posts with, like, ears nailed to... It feels like that one asshole in your neighborhood that thinks they totally get Halloween and they are super into Halloween, but all that really means is they buy the most disgusting decorations from those gypsy-like nomadic stores that show up in what used to be like a Circuit City
in a strip mall. Yeah,
yeah. And they buy all the grossest shit. They don't buy the scary stuff. They don't buy the stuff that's, you know, that is relevant to the classic movies. They buy just like, oh, this is like a rat with three heads and it's all splattered everywhere and this is just guts. And it's like, yeah, but that's not interesting. You're just being gross for the sake of being gross. Like, and that's how this movie hits me. That's how, when we get to the moments where it's literally just, let's put the pieces of his face together and let's spin this post and look, is that an eyeball? Is that an ear? I don't know. It's like walking through a desperate haunted house. And that's the thing that doesn't work for me.
See, oddly enough, that is the stuff that does work for me. I love the aesthetics of this movie. I love the fact of these movies, plural. I love the fact that Clive Barker is trying to put on screen his impression of what hell might be like. Like, this is all impressionistic gore being used to define hell, because hell is a concept that we all have and we all understand in this modern society, but we all have different impressions on what it is. And the classical, hey, you're in fire and getting poked in the ass by a devil with a trident just isn't really scary. So what is something that is truly torturous and scary to us? And I love that this is what is in his head is what is scary. Is it totally what my impression of it is? No, but I love that this is his, and so that works for me. My problem with this film is on a much more fundamental level. So let's just get into my big problem with the film by asking a question.
Okay. Let the hooks come out. Let's rip it apart. Come on.
Who is the protagonist of Hellraiser?
The girl.
Oh, really? Character who's in 3 minutes of the first act and 5 minutes of the second act is the protagonist of the movie?
I'm not arguing the structure
is
sound.
That is my problem with this movie. This movie doesn't actually have a functioning protagonist. For the bulk of the film, the person who we spend the most time with, the person who is technically the protagonist of this movie, is Julia.
Yeah.
But we're made to hate her and not want anything to do with her and sympathize with her stepdaughter, who's almost not even in the movie until the third act.
True.
And that's why I really like watching this.
She's literally staying in a motel just outside the movie, doing everything she can to not be in the movie. Like, no, you guys go have fun. I'm going to go stay at the motel.
Yeah, because if I end up staying here, I'm going to definitely hear Frank moving around upstairs, because you'll believe that the herpy-derpy husband who doesn't pay attention to anything doesn't notice this, that his brother is slowly reincarnating up in the murder room that has no other purpose.
No.
Which, by the way, every movie in a Hellraiser film, apparently everyone owns houses where they can just have a murder room to chain people up.
All right,
beat them to death with hammers.
We've hired a great young architect for our new summer home. We're very excited. His name is Theodore Bundy. He's slated to do a really good job. He's a bit of a penchant for big soundproof basements and murder room attics. We're not really sure what that's about.
Yeah, but so in this movie. And it's what's so frustrating about this movie. It's the same problem with Phantom Menace. It's the same problem with World of Warcraft.
Too much Jar Jar Binks.
No, it is a movie in which we're not spending time with people we're supposed to care about. Like, our character, who by the end of the movie you assume is the protagonist, and when you think back on Hellraiser, you go, of course, Kirsty. Is it Kirsty or Christy? I forget which one is.
I believe it is Kirsty.
Kirsty,
which makes me not like her. And that takes her down a notch in likability right there.
Yeah,
just be Kirsty, goddammit.
Yeah. She's not in that. She like shows up after they've got the house, and you know, she goes and makes tea, and then she, we see her for a minute in a pet store where she's gotten a job and watches a guy eat crickets.
Yeah.
And then she goes out to dinner with her dad, and her dad says, hey, would you please stop by and check in on Julia, because she's not going out. And that's where she enters the movie at the end of the second act, where she's like, hey, I'm finally making an active choice in this movie as a character. I'm going to move forward and have some kind of growth. Oh, look, my stepmother is fucking some dude in the house. I think I'm going to go in and check on him. And then discovers that, of course, she's murdering people. And then the whole movie spins wildly out of control. And that is where she joins. It's, you know, player two has joined the movie. It takes her forever to become a part of this film. The film is about Julia, and you're never allowed to like Julia or care about her mission. Like, it's not presented in a way where she is sympathetic at all. So she is clearly the antagonist of the movie along with Frank. And yet we don't spend any time with anyone we care about, which is what is so this movie. And all of this stems from one simple fact, and that is that Clive Barker is a visionary writer. He created stuff that inspired me as a kid, as a writer, that I've carried with me. I love his work. I love his writing, but he directed three films, and he is a terrible director, and that is on display here to no end. Shots he chooses are not only bizarre at times, they are amateurish. The editing is very ham-fisted. The character development is very hit or miss. You can't tell me anything about Kirsty at all, and she's supposed to be the protagonist. Like, who is she? Well, she's the daughter of this dude, and her mom died, and she's really kind of broken up about the horrible thing she sees. That's the extent of her development in this film.
She's the kind of actress who Clive Barker was probably hoping audience members would get drunk and think was Winona Ryder. You know, and everything you're saying makes total sense, and they're very valid points, but all I can think about now is Jar Jar Binks as one of the Cenobites.
Not leaving us so soon, are you?
Let me talk about a Cenobite for a moment, because this is another thing that has always bugged me. No, because I love the Cenobites. But let me just nail down part of the problem
nail
of this
movie.
Nail
to a post like an ear.
Let's nail to the post like an ear. What is the name of the leader of the Cenobites?
It's Pinhead.
Okay. What is the name of the guy who chats his teeth throughout the series?
Chatterbox.
Yes. That is
that
his
right?
name. That is correct.
I pulled out of my ass.
What is the name of the Cenobite who is fat and gooey and goopy and wears glasses?
Associate Bob.
He's Butterball.
Oh, okay. That makes
He's Butterball.
Sense.
What is the name of the female Cenobite?
Penhelen?
Female Cenobite.
Oh, okay.
Her name is literally, they give names to every other Cenobite, and she, the only other Cenobite to get fucking dialogue in the series. Chatterbox never talks. Butterball never fucking talks.
Can we talk about the irony that he's called Chatterbox and he never speaks? Just saying. And Associate Bob doesn't speak.
In another movie, I believe she's referred to as Lady Cenobite. So they class it up a bit.
Yeah, pain and pleasure indivisible.
But it's literally, we put a wire hanger through her neck and we call her female Cenobite. Like,
oh,
that is,
she's Joan Crawford.
It's,
I get it now. Okay. Joan Crawford in hell as a Cenobite.
Or botched abortion Cenobite. I don't know how dark you want to get in this episode.
I don't know what I'm doing. I'm like,
yeah.
Throwing it to
like air punching on, you know, and throwing it to something.
I'm throwing it to
know.
The band for the rim shot, and there's no, we don't
I've
have a house band.
I've always been bothered by the fact
Chatterbox
that,
on drums.
Like, we literally have come up with all these names for these other, you know, Cenobites, and one of the other Cenobites that doesn't have a name just gets female Cenobite. It's just, it's always stuck in my craw a bit. And so it was just instantly reminded of this last night where it's like, oh, yeah, it's Lady Cenobite. And then the credits, oh, yeah, this is when she was still female Cenobite.
Back when she was still cool. The Cenobite hipster fan.
Yeah, but so, yeah, this is, it's a really great concept. There's really great gore. The music is amazing. It is, but it is put together so sloppily, and it is a dream logic movie. Like, the second half of the movie only makes sense if you adopt Italian dream logic.
Thank you. I was like, there is no way in hell that Clive Barker was not influenced by Argento. Because there is so much about this movie that is just ripped from the fucking Argento playbook.
Oh, with the visual blown out, you know, light in places where everything's just so bright and hazy in the way that the Italians did it. And then, like, John Woo adopted in the late 80s and early 90s. Yeah,
or
like,
characters who show up just to be creepy, say nothing, and eat that whole cricket eating scene. I'm like, this is something out of fucking Creepers right here. This is something out of... this is like every Argento movie has that weird sort of looming character that just doesn't say anything. And there's literally a shot. The first time you see that homeless dude, you just see his face as if he's holding up a flashlight and like, I'm here, which is such a fucking, like, if not Argento, definitely a Fulci touch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and he does make sense. You do realize that he is the guy that shows up at the end that's really the demon that takes the box back.
No, I'm not, yeah. That's not what I'm saying. It's not the logic of him. It's the way he's presented.
Oh, yeah.
It's exactly how the character is executed. The fact that he never, that scene where she's like, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? And then just eats a handful of crickets. That's such a fucking Argento scene. Like, the whole time I'm like, I expect to hear goblins start playing at any point.
Also, I'm endlessly fascinated by trying to figure out where the fuck this movie is set. Like, all we're told three times in the movie that it's better than Brooklyn. That's all we're taught. We spend more time talking about Brooklyn and New York City than this place that they've just moved.
Look, I don't want to start a fight here, but I mean, Clive Barker basically said hell's better than Brooklyn. So go get him, you mooks. Yeah. And also, did you notice who's playing Larry in this movie? The cuckolded, inefficient, the weakling father of this family. It's Andrew Robinson, who played the fucking killer in Dirty Harry.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is he does really great in this movie, and everyone forgets how great he is in this movie because he's not actually Frank when he's playing Frank. Like,
he's a better Frank than Frank, if I can be frank.
He is. No, when he starts playing Frank, he outdoes the guy that they got for 2 minutes of Frank.
Oh, and speaking of Italian horror movies, correct me if I'm wrong, is Frank dubbed the entire movie? Because the voice that's coming out of him and him do not, like, something doesn't gel about that. If it doesn't gel, it's not mustard, and there's no mustard here. Like, that voice coming out of him, especially in that opening where he's like, hi, it's me, I'm Brother Frank. And I'm like,
I'm here for the wedding.
I'm like, that's not your voice. Like, what was wrong with your voice that they did this? But, yeah, no, it's very weird. It's very dreamlike. And actually, the relationship between Frank and Julia is my favorite part of this movie because, yes, it's a little on the nose, and I know I'm saying that about a movie that literally has noses nailed to wood, but it's this whole, like, the hell of their relationship versus actual hell, and, ooh, baby, do you know what that's worth? Oh, hell is a place on earth. I get it. Like, you're drawing these parallels that are, like, in double Sharpie. Like, I see it. But that's the part that works for me, and the part that I feel is probably very well contained within the short story. And if I were reading a short story that was just about a woman trying to resurrect someone she had had an affair with by, you know, kind of being drawn into his web of really kind of dark places and murder and like that, I'm totally in for that. It's when you start going full Cenobite that it really doesn't work for me because of the incongruity of the tone that you've set with that love story. And then it's also this gory thing. I don't know. Like, for me, that was where I started drawing a disconnect. Like, I think this almost noirish gory film is good, but then when it goes too far in that direction, I start tuning out.
Jesus wept.
Yeah, and see, I'm fine with that. Like, the Cenobites showing up and most everything with the Cenobites is great. I've had this problem for 30 fucking years. I'm just gonna say it.
Well, you know there are pills for that.
There are. It is so Kirstie sends three of the Cenobites back to hell. And that's really cool how she does it. She's figuring out the puzzle box, she's using it to futz around and sends them back, and that's great. And then Butterball just gets caught in the collapse of the house.
Yep.
Like, just cuz. And it's like she never sent him back to hell. So what the fuck actually happens to Butterball?
Mr. Bundy, I have one little gripe about the design of the house. It seems the archway in the living room is very unstable. I'm not really sure what the point of that is. Is it, it's so more people can die accidentally as you're murdering them upstairs and down? Okay, sure. I guess that's how Associate Bob Cenobite will meet his end. Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Nor does that point in this movie where you realize they ran out of money. And it's very
That's the thing about both the Hellraiser movies have a struggle with budgets, which is part of what I love about them. Like, the fact is there's very little budget to these movies and they are made with so much passion that I totally forgive. And we'll get into this even more, because if you think they ran out of money on this movie, wait till we get to talking about Hellraiser 2 and some of the foibles of Hellraiser 2.
Yeah, the money train didn't just stop. It ran off the rails. But I want to say one thing about Hellraiser. They've been talking for a long time about remaking this movie, and it's never come to fruition. And part of the reason for that, I think, is that Frank as a character kind of fades into the ether with the onset of internet pornography. Because it's like a character who's just like, oh, I've done everything and I can't be sated. I don't know. But the minute the internet and Two Girls, One Cup is invented, it's like this character is no longer going to Morocco to find a fucking puzzle box. Like,
oh, I completely disagree with you. I think that you just wrestle with the idea of porn creep there and the fact that literally he's been exposed to so much.
Which is the Cenobite you don't see in this
That
movie.
Is correct. I think the problem with making a Hellraiser remake is that there's probably somebody in the creative process that's saying, no, it needs to be a direct remake of Hellraiser. And people are going, this story is so thin to begin with, it barely exists in as a movie on its own. If you're going to do it, you do one and two together. Like, you just merge one and two into one Hellraiser movie, and you spend more time developing the Cenobites, and you get more into the world building that we see in two. Because that's where things start truly getting fascinating. And I think that's a great segue into it.
No more teasing. Time to play.
Because I don't hate Hellraiser. I just have a love-hate relationship with it. That,
yeah.
I mean, I enjoy watching it, but it is deeply flawed. I have a hard time saying I love it. I just notice all the flaws of it. Every time I watch it, I find more flaws, which it's a very different experience with Hellraiser 2, where every time I watch it, I see even more flaws, and I don't care. It endears me more to it, because the second film is a fully fleshed out story with a protagonist, a beginning, a middle, and end, crazy, crazy ambition that exceeds its grasp.
I'm not even going to point out the irony of you referring to any movie in this franchise as fully fleshed out. When there's literally flesh being ripped from bones.
But you know what? This movie opens, you know who the protagonist is, and we stay with her the entire movie. And we get other interesting characters. We get a villain plot that actually makes some sense. It starts getting super wacky and goes off the rails in the best way. And we actually see characters make very real choices in terms of character growth, as opposed to the first movie where everybody is so reactive.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you argued that the best way to watch Hellraiser is in conjunction with Hellraiser 2 Hellbound, which is why we're doing these both together on this episode. And I have to agree with that, because watching Hellraiser 2 Hellbound did not feel like Hellraiser 2 Hellbound. It felt like Hellraiser 2 Dream Warriors. Because
yeah.
It is almost identical in structure and plot to Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors.
Yes.
And I kind of fucking loved that about it.
Yes.
In fact, I had to look it up on the IMDb to prove to myself that the girl protagonist in this, who's not Kirstie, wasn't the girl from Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Oh, I can definitely tell you that, because I have had a crush on that girl for 25 years now, or longer, like close to 30 years. That blonde girl, she's just slightly older than me when this movie came out, and that was just like, bam, that is the pinnacle of what teenage me thought was awesome.
Hey, it's me, Porn Creep Cenobite.
Yeah.
I've been following this girl for 25 years. No.
I have not been, like, I can't actually tell you her name off the top of my head. So I haven't
for
quite
legal reasons.
Porn Creep, but I love the accent on Porn Creep Cenobite.
Yeah, it's me, Porn Creep Cenobite. No.
He's even stealing Chatterbox's bit.
Like, I just love the fact that that's even ookier than how crazy the Cenobites get in this series.
Totally. And this is the movie that, like, I feel when I said that Pinhead, by the way, Doug Bradley is Pinhead, fucking amazing.
Oh,
like,
yes.
That, and going back to Hellraiser for just a moment, Doug Bradley made possibly the world's greatest career choice. When he was faced with his Lady or the Tiger doorway of his career, he picked the right goddamn door. Monty Hall did not fuck over Doug Bradley, because apparently Clive Barker offered him one of two roles in Hellraiser. The first was lead Cenobite, which is just who he was called in the script. The other was one of the two movers carrying the mattress up the stairs at the beginning of the movie, which Doug Bradley considered because at least he wouldn't have to be in makeup. And as an actor just trying to make his bones, he was like, well, people will see my face. I mean, I know this is a bigger part, but at least if I play one of the movers, people will see my face. I guess I'll give this Pinhead thing a try. And he's still fucking playing Pinhead to this day. He has never stopped being Pinhead since 1987.
He's tried to break out of it and do other stuff. He has appeared in other movies, and he's tried to get movies off the ground. Well, because we actually do get to see his face in this movie.
Correct. And this is where I was going, is that he is a sideline character in his own movie in the first one, and this feels like a move so much later in the franchise, where you actually go and you see what these people look like before, you know, the pleasure demons got their hooks in them and they became Cenobites, and not the least of which being Doug Bradley, who at the beginning of this movie is some kind of colonel who...
He's a World War I officer.
Yeah, and you kind of see his demise, and then this movie becomes literally about the lesser of several evils.
Yeah.
Because what we actually watch as a new, even more sadistic Cenobite is born and decides he wants to take over the crew. So you actually start siding with the Cenobites. And I just feel like part two, really early to go that route, but kind of makes up for a lot of the lack of depth to the Cenobites
early
in the first one.
In the series to go that route.
Yeah.
Not early in the 80s to go that route. This is exactly where the 80s was and why this movie had such an impact on horror fans, because it was so big and broad in its storytelling. It felt like there was a big expanded universe. In fact, when this movie came out, there was a lot of fan canon going on, a lot of headcanon that Freddy Krueger was a Cenobite. that Jason was a Cenobite that had managed to manifest in flesh. There was a lot of this kind of, these monsters are all these things from hell that have come out to do these things. And the fact that we saw the origin of a new Cenobite and then discovered that these Cenobites, who believed that they were eternal and had always existed, had not even existed outside of this century.
Yeah.
Was a really awesome idea, in that the horrors of hell were ever evolving, and that these creatures would adapt to the times. And so what we saw was we saw Doug Bradley's Pinhead, who had been a Cenobite for less than a century, already being outmoded by this new Cenobite that had a very different idea. And they never really go into it, but the film is so subtle, and what Tony Randall does with it.
The director of Ticks,
and Hellraiser, Hellbound Hellraiser 2. By the way, interesting point to be made about Hellraiser. Why is it called Hellraiser? It's named Hellraiser after Julia. Julia is the Hellraiser. Like, literally this entire series is named after this woman.
God. Like, shades of Frankenstein. People refer to Pinhead sometimes as the Hellraiser. And I'm like, no, that's not. She's the Hellraiser. It's Frankenstein.
She's raising
monster.
This guy from hell. Like, that is the point. So, but I love the transformation of the doctor here. And I love the fact that the doctor has always been into it. The doctor has always been a sadist. The doctor has always done fucked up things. As we learn, the doctor may or may not have been responsible for the death of Tiffany's mother.
For seemingly no reason.
No, he discovered that she was super obsessed with puzzles and needed to have her on lockdown to solve the puzzle boxes so he could get into it. He's had the puzzle boxes for years. Like, that's the whole thing with the doctor. The doctor has been trying to get into hell to become a Cenobite for a bulk of his life.
Yeah.
He is devoted to it. He believes in it. And he finally, when he finally finds it, that's why Leviathan takes to him and sends Julia up to come claim him so that he can become a new Cenobite and even more dangerous, disturbing Cenobite. Because, you know, let's face it. Watching one and two together as one extended 3-hour movie, which is exactly how this should be watched.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, carve out 3 hours and 7 minutes of your night. Watch both of them. They're literally on almost every streaming platform known to man. I know for a fact that they're on Netflix and Shudder. And if you want to rent them from other places, it's like a 99-cent rental each. Like, this is, it is almost impossible not to trip over
a Hellraiser movie. Might be too high a price point, 99 cents, for the subsequent Hellraiser movies, as it turns out.
The Dark Devil, is he?
When you watch these as a 3-hour movie together, the Cenobites are kind of fucking weak.
Yeah.
Like, in the 80s, we thought they were awesome and terrifying, and when you watch it in retrospect, they show up and they talk a lot of shit, but they don't ever really do anything.
But they are constantly outwitted by Kirstie.
By Kirstie, who outwits them, by saying, I'm going to go out the door now. Bye.
Yeah.
Damn it. She's foiled us again.
We had functioning arms, or maybe like these fucking hook things that, guys, you got to turn on the hook sooner before she leaves. Yes, Dave, before she fucking leaves.
If only we had a budget to make the Cenobites be able to move and actually react when they battle the new improved Dr. Cenobite.
I just have one fucking question. I know. Listen to me. I know. Forget the pins for a second. I have one question. Do all the idiots come to hell and all the smart people get saved? Why the fuck? Dave, the hooks. You missed the cue again.
Now, I love joking about that, but in terms of the movie, the opening the box, like as we see when they show up for Tiffany in this movie, the Cenobites start to approach Tiffany and Pinhead calls him up and goes, no, it's not hands that call us. It is desire. So the whole point of them is like, and I love that when you tie that together with angels to some, demons to others, they're not there as scary monsters to kill you the way that Jason or Freddy is.
They're Faustian.
They're Faustian. They're literally like, hey, you are really into some sick shit and you wanted to see the sickest shit imaginable. That's us. It's kind of like that dominatrix that you can hire in Vegas where it's just like, okay, now sign this form and say that this is going to happen. And once we get into the room, you're not going to have any control over what goes on unless you say the safe word. But once you say the safe word, it's out and we charge your credit card. Yeah. Okay. Once we get in there, I'm going to be awful. Are you okay to go in there? That's who they are. Kirstie never wants that.
See, and that's a big, but I get what you're saying, but that creates such a giant fucking plot hole in the first one.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does, because she doesn't have the desire at all when she opens the box.
Which is why they never kill her.
But they try to. She has to fucking outsmart them. In the second one, he says, we're not going to take Tiffany because it's not hands that call us his desire. And it's like, where was that fucking logic when you were totally going to take Kirstie and she had zero desire?
I have a very, very strong feeling that was an attempt to retcon what went wrong in the
that
first movie.
I would agree with. And that's why
I love this movie. This movie makes Hellraiser.
It's paving the plot holes.
It is paving the plot holes. It makes it a better movie. It makes everything in that movie functional because every single plot point in that movie plays into 2. You cannot watch 2 really without, even though it's got flashbacks, you can kind of catch up, but it is really building upon what happened in the first movie.
Yeah.
But again, it's got a solid protagonist. She's got wants and desires. It's got a great secondary character in Tiffany. The doctor, his motivations totally make sense. He gives over to it. It's great. Julia has been dead for apparently 3 days and comes back with a completely different hairstyle because that's what happens in hell.
Well, technically,
like if there's any flaw in this movie that you kind of have to really pay over, it's that she's been dead for like 3 days and comes back and she's like, wine. Like, oh my God, it's been 3 days without wine.
To be fair, it's 3 days in hell, which I'm sure feels a lot longer than 3 days. And secondly,
and that's
She comes back without skin. I think we can let the hairstyle go. She comes back skinless, Cargill. There's a lot that's changed for this bitch in 3 days.
She grows back a new head of hair. It's great. She goes new hairstyle, different color. You know, she's not a redhead with severe hair anymore. It is now nice flowing brunette.
Well, you saw everything when she was skinless. She's not a natural redhead.
But see, that's the thing, is that this movie actually allows you to be like, oh, what is 3 days in hell like? Like, how long was Kirstie and Tiffany in hell?
Yeah.
When they finally go into hell in this movie, which is where this movie really, really takes off. Like, is this movie a perfect indefensible film?
No. It wouldn't be on this show if it was perfect and indefensible.
That's not true. We've had some perfect and indefensible films. perfect and defensible films. But
you're going to say Battle Beyond the Stars again, aren't you?
No, I wasn't. Because that I love that movie, but you've got to explain some things away. This one in particular, though, what I admire about it is its ambition.
Oh, my God,
when
yes.
When we get to hell... Hell is really cool, even though there's a moment where Kirstie leans up against a stone wall and it wobbles because it's clearly made of cardboard and plywood.
Can I just say that I am so grateful that even though he's been dead for years, M.C. Escher is still getting work as the architect of hell.
But that's awesome. And that matte painting is so fucking cool.
It really is. Like, it legitimately is. But at certain points when they're running around in this hell maze, I'm just like, when does David Bowie show up? I can't wait for David Bowie to show up.
Dude, that. And then you've got like those really crazy stop motion snake fingers doing all the weird shit. And you've got, you know, this great cool design of this doctor, you know, floating around on this big like armature that's got the saw in it that he's using to cut open somebody's brain earlier in the movie. Like, there's so much cool, ambitious design work in here and cool concepts. And by the way, my favorite concept of hell of all time is in this movie. Frank's hell is really fucking awesome. It's all of these ghost women groaning and moaning and masturbating, waiting for Frank to fuck them. And the minute you lift the sheet, they vanish. And as he says, they promise forever and never deliver.
Oh, he did discover internet porn. Okay.
That's just it. Like, that's the thing, is he can't, he's stuck in a hell. He is a guy that has spent his entire life wanting to get off, and he can't get off anymore. And like, that's what his promise was. You know, going here and experiencing this pleasure and pain. And instead, he gets banished to a hell where he's just so unsatisfied that he fakes being his own brother to lure his niece into hell so he can fuck his niece. A fact that, by the way, never gets addressed by it like that. Like, it's like we know that it's Uncle Frank, but dear God, the incest. Like, this
more
guy
like,
is
more
so-
like Uncle Touchy.
This guy is so deep into his perversion that this is what excites, like, you know what? Fucking my brother's wife isn't hot anymore, but fucking his daughter. Yes.
Uncle Touchy's puzzle basement.
Exactly. And that is, and so that's like his big plot in there. And it's like, fuck.
By the way, can we just talk for a second about how, because I like this movie a lot too. And I think I agree with you. The only way to watch these is together, but being good at puzzles as a defining character arc is fucking crazy to me. Like, it's like, who is she, Edward Nygma? Like, why is it a big deal that she's good at puzzles?
Well, no, the thing is, it's not that she's good at puzzles. She's obsessed with puzzles, which is why her mother brings her to the doctor. Like, it's clearly affecting her view of the outside world. And then once she watches her mother killed by the doctor, she doesn't speak again until she finally says, shit, later in the movie, and then decides to start having conversations again.
Sure. One good piece of profanity will do that for you. And by the way, if the first movie was really on the nose with it drawing a parallel between actual hell and the hell of that relationship, this movie is deviating your septum on the nose with the parallel between actual hell and the hospital that these patients are in under our doctor friend. I mean, I have expected at one point when they're going cell to cell to see Neil in like the next one. They open the door and he's like, Sutter Kane lives! Sutter Kane lives! Okay, just close and move on to the next
one. Oh yeah,
one.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that in my head canon, that's where he is.
Yeah.
Is at the bottom of this.
Just like, all the upside down crosses.
That's the thing is Hellbound Hellraiser 2 is such an expansive mythology that you can actually wrap up a whole bunch of the movies that came out at that same time into this universe together, and you're not necessarily wrong.
Well, and I think part of the reason for that is that 80% of the Hellraiser franchise existed as something else before it was Hellraiser. I mean, it's like Die Hard. It's like where like all of these scripts is like, well, we got this horror script. It's kind of weak. Can you put Cenobites in it? Now it's a Hellraiser sequel. Go, you're greenlit. And it's like, but it doesn't make sense. Go, Cenobites. Fly, my monkeys. And then you got a franchise. You have a franchise that is more pieced together than that weird face on the floor at the beginning of the first movie.
And yet we do keep finding each other, don't we?
This movie, the second movie, Hellbound, feels like a demo reel for practical effects. More so than a movie, really. It's just, we're going to do some really crazy shit. Like, if you thought the first one was crazy, we're going to do some really crazy shit. And the reason that that actually worked for me is that it matches the tone of the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Whereas in the first one, I felt like that shit was actually at odds with kind of the more intensely personal story that was going on. And then it was just gore on top of that. Like, for me, there was just something that didn't quite come together about those two halves. But in this one, it's like, if you start it crazy, then you can get crazier because you've established crazy from the get-go. And that's what Hellbound Hellraiser 2 does. It establishes crazy right from the get-go. Speaking of crazy from the get-go, you know who's responsible for us even having Hellbound Hellraiser 2? Roger Corman. Roger Corman is the reason this fucking movie exists, because it was produced by New World.
Oh, yeah.
So if it weren't for Roger Corman, there would be no Hellraiser 2. And to me, that is a perfect marriage of crazy.
Yeah, and it's the thing is, it's so delightfully crazy. Like, it is doing very, very cool things with horror in this era where everything else was spinning out and was running out of juice. And, you know, in a period of time where, you know, Freddy went off the rails and Jason went off the rails and, you know, horror was just about to die. Like, we're in the era right before horror got so bad it took Scream to bring it back. Oh, and then man. We got 5 years of teenage mask killers.
The nouveau slasher, yeah.
Yeah. Like, this was at the tail end of that, and this was something that was literally trying to be something else. And that's what was admirable about Hellraiser as well, is it was trying to do something new and different. Even though I feel Hellraiser fails miserably on several points, everything that it does right, it does really well, and it was trying to be different. And this one does that and accomplishes it. This is a great midnight movie. This is one of those movies that you watch and you're like, this is like, and the thing is it reminds me, like, I was reminded of this movie when I watched The Void.
Yes. Because I can definitely see that.
This is, I'm like, The Void keeps promising to become this and never does. You know, the Void keeps like coming right up to the edge of being a Saul Bass, like the last eight minutes of fucking Phase 4. And just promising to be that. And you're like, oh, and then every time it's just about to do that, literally someone with an axe runs into a room to hit somebody. Like, it keeps like, you don't want to see crazy. And we're like, no, we really fucking do. And this fucking goes bonkers. When they walk into hell, it's just fucking hell. Like, yeah, is there some labyrinth elements? Yes. Are there some MC Escher elements? Yes. Is it done with cool gore and creature effects? Fuck yes. And then they play around with hell. And then we get crazy shit like Julia's skin coming off.
Yeah.
And then Kirstie wearing the skin.
Like an Egger suit.
Yeah. Like, it's... it's wonderful. And it's so cool how fucked up and weird its logic is, but it's not like the first film where you have to incorporate dream logic. Once you walk into hell, you know you're in hell logic. Like, there's no question. Like, whatever happens, you're in fucking hell.
Oh, right down to the, when you get to the center of the hell maze, and it basically is that scene from The Keep, and there's just that big fucking floating obelisk.
Leviathan.
Yeah, Leviathan. who is like, return the map, return what you have stolen from... No, I'm sorry, he's like, you must fight for the users. No, he's like,
no,
it's so many things I've
shines,
seen before.
Like, he's... another thing I love about this fucking movie, Leviathan is the box. That's the whole thing, is he's a giant puzzle box, and he's like a lighthouse, but instead of shining light, he shines pure darkness, and when you're hit by it, you see all the darkest elements of your soul and your past, and I think that's a cool fucking idea.
Well, yes, but that's because you read the exact wrong literature from Jehovah's Witnesses, because you're just like, the lighthouse shines imminent darkness forever and ever, amen. And it's like, I think the wrong people came to your door. I'm just saying.
It's fucking cool, and I love it. And yeah, when you look at it, is it kind of goofy special effects? Yes. Do the walls wobble when they run past them? Yeah, sometimes they do. Sometimes they do.
Oh, don't you forget, I'm down here, and I'm not even dead yet, but it still kind of makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. makes a lot of sense.
Oh, boy, me and Frank are going to be roommates. We got the same hell, don't you know?
It's like, oh, God.
I can't wait to mix a drink for Frank.
Oh, shit.
By the way, saying Edgar suit just makes me wish that young, late 80s Vincent D'Onofrio would have played Frank, because that would have been fucking awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. D'Onofrio would have been great. Vincent Gallo, if we're going to stick with the Vincents. A young Vincent Gallo.
It's me, Vincent Gallo, Cinnabite. You want to be in a movie where you suck my dick?
I just realized what that is. It's creepy, pervier Stan Lee.
Yeah, you've gone to a really... like, I say you, we've gone to a really dark place this episode.
Would
like,
you
I,
say we've gone I, to a hell maze?
I made that wire hanger joke. Like, I'm ashamed of myself at this point.
We've entered the night
circle. I need
circle.
Cenobites to come and punish me for the jokes I've been making in this episode.
You know what?
Let alone laughing at the ones you're making, for fuck's sake.
We're in the ninth circle. Excelsior. I'm just saying.
Yeah, no. Not in the house that Stan built. Fuck off.
The house that Stan built is a hell maze. Hey, there's Bowie.
Yeah, no, now I just want a Labyrinth Hellraiser crossover. But like you said, you could put so many other horror movies into this franchise, and this movie is like the nexus point of that.
Yeah, and it's really, this movie in particular is entertaining throughout. There's a couple moments where you're like, really? In where it kind of tests logic. It's not out of the realm of possibility, but you're like, that's not the smartest character decision. But at the same time, you're like, fuck it, I see where they're going. And once this movie firmly gets entrenched in its second act, this movie is just a rocket on rails in terms of just batshit crazy.
It does not stop with the crazy.
It doesn't. And it's great, and it's entertaining, and I love the way that Kirstie accidentally fucks over the Cenobites.
Yeah.
Like, she, by revealing them to be human, they start to question themselves and their power. And the doctor, the psychiatrist of all things, breaks them down to their base elements and kills them. Like, on a metaphorical level, there's a lot of cool shit going on in this movie.
I mean, I know the Cenobites literally rip the skin off of people, but he really dresses them down. The doctor really dresses down the Cenobites, and it makes me want to know more about the backstories of Butterball and Chatterbox and Girl.
Female Cenobites.
I want to know more about Girl's backstory. By the way, this sequel does two things that, as an avid lover of terrible horror sequels, I appreciate so much. One is the last week on Hellraiser that it does, where for like 10 minutes, it's Deadly Night 2.
It's literally, it's not that bad. It's only 2 minutes that, like, we get 2 minutes of base explanation of the opening of the first film.
You see Crazy Ralph die again. It's just, you know, you see
and then
Freddy
Krueger
get
burned again.
We have a
quick flashback later in the movie again, where we see a movie that a scene that I assume is outtakes from the first movie, where we actually see the wedding, because we don't see the wedding in the first movie, and there's footage of the wedding in the second movie. And I'm like, that's got to be outtakes. Like, they had to have shot that and just used it and gotten the rights to, you know, to use that again. Unless they went and shot that scene for this movie, but why would you do that? Like, it doesn't, like, it's got to be outtakes.
And the other thing it does so well is, like, when Julia shows up with no skin, you know from the first movie what has to happen for her to be kind of corporeal again. So they cut to the end of that. They go immediately from like him making out with her skinless to an attic full of dead people. And she's like, okay, great. It's great to be human again. It's like, oh, I guess we're just going to drive right by all of that murder and dive into this crazy story now. But they literally do the first movie again in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So they show you the first movie again in 5 minutes, and then they do the first movie again in 5 minutes, and then you're off to the races with a whole new train of crazy.
Yeah. If I had to complain about that sequence, there's two things that bother me about it. And one is that she comes back fully bloody, like almost complete Frank on the first try.
I want to go full Frank.
I love the animatronic Frank from the first movie. I love the look of that, of him when he's this desiccated corpse, desperately in need of blood.
We're getting goopy again.
And it's really there's a patheticness to him that helps you understand why he dives in so well. And here she comes out like, I need blood. And it's like, no, you don't. You're like almost fully bloody. And now you just need skin, right? Yeah. No. I need to kill like 12 people.
Can we talk about, by the way, how hell is apparently Arkham Asylum? Because people keep getting out. Like Frank gets out in the first one and the Cenobites are like, no one has ever escaped us. And Kirstie's like, hi, I'm 16, and I can prove that you're wrong. Somebody got out. And then in the second one, Julia's just out again. Like, hell is apparently Arkham Asylum.
Leviathan let her out, though. She actually says that
dastardly lighthouse
in the movie, that Leviathan let her out to bring in this new Cenobite, because he's constantly needing new Cenobites to up the sadism, because it's like, you know what? After almost 100 years, like, this chain and hook thing, like, it's not really, like, doing it for anybody anymore. Can we get somebody who wants like blades for fingers and, you know, like, and has like snake stuff and like floats around, is really kind of genuinely creepy and really seems to enjoy this. Yeah, sure. Let's go get that dude. And then you get that great moment. Oh, that moment from him. It's one of my favorite moments in the movie, where he comes, when he first emerges from the box after he's been tortured, and he's like, and to think I hesitated.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, that's such a cool character.
It's his Project
concept.
Runway moment where, yeah, Tim Gunn's like, I think you made it work. And he proceeds to be the biggest.
What show did you just quote?
Project Runway.
What is that? I'm not familiar with that.
Married with Kids. I get to make those references. That's how it works.
It's called
folks.
Married with Children, and it's from the 80s.
Feel free. Explore. Have eternity to know your flesh.
So, Cargill, what's a word we've used about 500 times during the course of this episode?
Batshit?
No. Referring to specific characters in this movie.
Crazy?
No.
One note?
No, the actual proper name for certain characters in this movie.
Oh, Cenobites.
What do you think this week's junk food pairing might be if you had to take a stab?
Oh, God, no, you did not.
Cenobites!
You did not.
Cinnabon's miniature cinnamon rolls are called Cenobites. Ladies and gentlemen, get a giant box.
I'm so ashamed to be your friend right now.
Of this weathered cinnamon roll flesh that you can then put back together or just consume. We have such fattening sights to show you and feed you, and in this case, it is a giant box of Cenobites. As you watch, in the only way to watch Hellraiser immediately followed by Hellraiser 2 Hellbound, or Hellbound Hellraiser.
And you know what really kind of works about those? Like, not only the name, the fact that they're sticky.
They're goopy.
And this movie is such a sticky movie.
Yes.
Like, it's like your fingers being sticky and like everybody keeps touching all the sticky shit. Like, yeah. No, I think you've actually got a winner on your hands there.
I feel like we have definitely, and I love that you called Hellbound the perfect midnight movie, because the way we're advocating watching it, you're gonna be up till 4 a.m so congratulations.
It's only 3 hours. Like, it's an hour and a half and an hour 37.
Well, you're gonna need an hour in between to heat up the Cenobites and get your fingers all
right.
Goopy.
Well, there you go.
Demons to some, angels to others.
Well, that's gonna do it for our first episode of Schlocktober 2, #Schlocktober2. If you would like to hear more of the things that we do,
use a hashtag for us, please.
#HashBrowns. If you would like to hear more of what we do, you can find our entire back catalog on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio, which is our network and home. You can also follow us on Twitter @JunkFoodCinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/JunkFoodCinema. If you really like the show, if it is the perfect mix of pleasure and pain for you, Go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and pledge. Even as little as a dollar an episode gets you access to bonus content, and it really does keep the lights on. And not to be like a pathetic shill here, but I got a wedding coming up, and like things you keep having to buy and sign for, and it's like, holy shit, who knew weddings were expensive? So go to patreon.com.
The guy who's married?
Yeah, I know. Fuck you. Go to patreon.com.
The guy was married once
cinema.
Before?
No. Go there, pledge money, end of shtick. Cargo, where can people find you on the internet?
On the internet.
All right.
Yeah, you can find me at Massaworm, MassaWyrm on both Instagram and Twitter. And you can find my new book, Sea of Rust, wherever you buy books.
And his upcoming book, which is basically 50 Shades of Grey written by Frank. And it gets real fucking ugly. Like, they're... Those shades, you don't want to mess with. That's all I'm going to say. You can find me on Twitter at BriarGuySalisbury, or my Facebook page is facebook.com/BriarSalisburyCritic. We are going to be back next week with a movie that... Wow.
I'm so excited about
it. I'm very excited about it, and I'm very excited for the reaction that we get from people, which is going to be, wait, who the fuck are you talking about? So we'll be back next week with that movie. You can listen to our back catalog and find other movies that we've talked about. I guess it really depends on what's your pleasure, sir.